Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Clinical Applications of the Polyvagal Theory, The Emergence of Polyvagal-Informed Therapies, edited by Stephen W. Porges and Deb Dana, narrated by Joe Hempel. Publisher's Note: This audiobook refers to figures and tables included in the print and e-book editions of the book. Preface: Why Polyvagal Theory Was Welcomed by Therapists. Stephen W. Porges. Polyvagal theory was unveiled to the scientific community on October 8, 1994. On that date in Atlanta, a polyvagal model with its theoretical implications was introduced in my presidential address to the Society for Psychophysiological Research. A few months later, the theory was disseminated as a publication in the Society's journal, Psychophysiology. The article was titled, Orienting in a Defensive World: Mammalian Modifications of Our Evolutionary Heritage, a Polyvagal Theory. The title, crafted to cryptically encode several features of the theory, was intended to emphasize that mammals had evolved in a hostile environment in which survival was dependent on their ability to down-regulate states of defense with states of safety and trust, states that supported cooperative behavior and health. The theory, as initially presented, did not propose applications to mental health and psychiatric disorders. The theory was proposed to generate testable hypotheses and to stimulate research expanding our understanding of how the autonomic nervous system influenced mental, behavioral, and physiological processes. Polyvagal theory was generated as an expansive brain-body model that emphasized the bidirectional communication between the brain and the body. The theory, with its strong evolutionary and developmental perspectives, was proposed as a framework to explore links among observable behaviors, psychological processes, and autonomic state. When the theory was initially presented, I was unaware that clinicians would embrace it. I had conceptualized the theory as a structure for generating testable hypotheses within the research community. Consistent with my initial expectations, the theory has had an impact in science and has been cited in several thousand peer-reviewed publications representing several disciplines, including neonatology, obstetrics, anesthesiology, biomedical engineering, internal medicine, psychology, psychiatry, dentistry, human factors, sociology, and philosophy. However, I did not anticipate that the main impact of the theory would be to provide plausible neurophysiological explanations for experiences described by individuals who have experienced trauma. For these individuals, the theory provided an understanding of how, after experiencing life threat, their neural reactions were retuned towards a defensive bias and they lost the resilience to return to a state of safety. Since the first presentation of polyvagal theory, there has been a great interest in applying the theory in clinical practice. This interest greatly expanded with the publication in 2011 by Norton of The Polyvagal Theory: Neurophysiological Foundations of Emotions, Attachment, Communication, and Self-Regulation. The publication of the book provided an opportunity for clinicians to obtain information on the theory that previously was available only through academic and digital libraries. During the 20-plus years since the publication of my presidential address, thousands of scientists have cited the theory in their research. However, more surprising has been the reception by the non-academic clinical world. An inspection of the number of web pages mentioning polyvagal theory is in the tens of thousands, and my talks on YouTube have cumulatively received several hundred thousand hits. Moreover, I have been interviewed on several podcasts, including Dr. Drew, Bulletproof Radio, Dharma Cafe, and Shrink Wrap Radio. The turning point for the transition of polyvagal theory from academic research to clinical application occurred on May 21, 1999, when Bessel van der Kolk invited me to talk at his annual Boston Trauma Conference. Bessel structured the program to focus on how neuroscience informed research on trauma. Being naive about trauma and the clinical histories of survivors of trauma, I was unaware that polyvagal theory could provide insights into understanding reactions to trauma and could inform treatment. A critical component of polyvagal theory is focused on the shift in neural regulation of the heart that occurred during vertebrate evolution, especially during the transition from the now extinct primitive reptiles to the first mammals. Through evolution, the neural regulation of the vertebrate autonomic nervous system progressed through three global stages, with the third stage being present only in mammals. By the time mammals evolved, all three stages were represented. 1. A uniquely mammalian circuit that calmed and cued others to calm. 2. A circuit that supported mobilization behaviors, including the fight or flight system. And 3. An ancient immobilization circuit represented in virtually all vertebrates that was capable of rapidly shutting down behavioral and physiological systems requiring metabolic resources. The mammalian calming circuit involved a vagal pathway as well as neural pathways regulating striated muscles of the face and head. The mobilization system involved the sympathetic nervous system and the adrenals. The ancient shutdown circuit involved a vagal pathway originating from a brainstem area different from the calming vagal pathway. Polyvagal theory provided an understanding of how mammals could shift from an aggressive fight-or-flight state to a calm state that would promote intimacy and optimize health, growth, and restoration. However, the theory also identified a very ancient defense system that, unlike the fight-or-flight system, was mediated by a vagal pathway that originated in an area of the brainstem different from the vagal pathway that calmed and down-regulated defense. Thus, the origins of the polyvagal theory were rooted in the neuroanatomical and neurophysiological shifts in the regulation of the vertebrate heart that occurred through evolution. These phylogenetic transitions resulted in mammals having two vagal pathways, one related to calm states and social communication, and the other related to an immobilization defense reaction. Within polyvagal theory, the newer mammalian vagal circuit was codified as the social engagement system. This circuit was most accessible during states of trust and safety. Withdrawal of this system enabled the efficient expression of a fight-or-flight system, while withdrawal of the fight-or-flight system uncovered an evolutionarily ancient shutdown system. The shutdown system, when enabled in mammals, results in fainting, defecation, and, as I would learn later, dissociation. This immobilization response was the body's attempt to become inanimate in the presence of a predator. It is important to note that neural mechanisms involved in the fight-or-flight system, that is, sympathetic nervous system, and the neural mechanisms involved in the shutdown system are also recruited during safe, calm states to efficiently support homeostasis and to enable play and intimacy. However, when not in a state of safety, the autonomic nervous system efficiently supports defensive strategies of fight or flight and shutdown. By understanding the phylogenetic changes in the neural regulation of the vertebrate autonomic nervous system, polyvagal theory proposed a hierarchy of reactions to challenges that paralleled evolution in reverse. This strategy was consistent with the construct of dissolution, or evolution in reverse, proposed by John Hewlings Jackson to explain the disinhibition of older brain structures when newer brain structures were damaged. The mechanism through which cues in the environment reflexively, without awareness, triggered massive adaptive shifts in autonomic state was subsequently added to the theory with the construct of neuroception. After presenting the theory at Bessel's Boston Trauma Meeting, I was informed that polyvagal theory provided a missing construct in the explanation of experiences following trauma. Prior to my presentation, the scientific explanation of the effects of trauma focused on the assumption that the trauma reactions were fight or flight reactions, mediated by the sympathetic nervous system and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal, HPA, axis. In general, these reactions have been clustered in the term stress. Consistent with this prevalent global stress model, survivors of trauma were categorized and diagnosed with a disorder known as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. The word stress within the diagnostic label fit nicely with an assumption that the trauma-related disruptions to homeostatic functions were due to alterations in sympathetic nervous system and HPA axis function. However, physiological data and personal experiences did not support this contention. Slowly, a different narrative emerged for survivors of trauma, which included a downregulation of the sympathetic nervous system and HPA axis, convergent with personal experiences of shutdown, immobilization, and dissociation. Polyvagal theory provided a neurophysiological model that coincided with the experiences of many survivors of trauma. Personal communications, such as the quote here, illustrate how polyvagal theory has provided survivors of abuse and trauma with a better understanding of bodily reactions. I read about the body immobilizing instead of fighting or fleeing. I am now 69, and when I was 18, I was nearly strangled and then sexually assaulted. Years later, I was speaking with my daughter about this incident, and she was disbelieving that I did what I did and that I froze. I felt so ashamed and judged. After reading your theory, I cannot tell you how excited and vindicated I feel. I'm crying right now. Personal Communication, 2013. Unlike many of my colleagues who treat and study trauma, trauma was not a focus of my research or part of my theoretical agenda. Without traumatologists being interested in polyvagal theory, there would not have been an entree for the theory to contribute to the understanding and treatment of trauma. This entree was due to three pioneers in traumatology: Peter Levine, Bessel van der Kolk, and Pat Ogden. Each has graciously welcomed me on their journey to understand and rehabilitate the disruptive effects of trauma. It was through their passion to help their clients, their commitment to learn, and their curiosity to understand the processes involved in experiencing and recovering from trauma that they embraced insights from the theory in their treatment models. My interactions with Peter started in the late 1970s, when Peter's curiosity led him to call me and discuss models of homeostatic function. At that time, I was developing time series statistical models to describe and quantify the vagal regulation of the heart from beat-to-beat heart rate variability. Peter and I became good friends, and in the late 70s and early 80s participated in think tank workshops on the neurobiology of emotion regulation. Over the years, I have seen Peter's insights crystallize and evolve into a powerful treatment model that became the basis of somatic experiencing. Through Peter, I was drawn into the community of somatic therapy. As I started to be invited to give talks in the more interdisciplinary and eclectic area of somatics and psychotherapy, I was on programs with Pat and Bessel in the 1990s. Pat was developing sensory-motor psychotherapy as a bridge between somatic therapy and psychotherapy. She, like Peter, emphasized the potent role of appropriately accessing and managing implicit memories. I met Bessel in the world of somatic therapists as he was on his passionate journey to help his clients. Through Pat, I was a frequent speaker at the annual meetings on attachment and trauma at UCLA, organized by Marion Solomon and the Lifespan Learning Institute. These meetings now form the focal point for clinicians interested in interpersonal neurobiology. At the Boston Trauma Meetings organized by Bessel and the UCLA Meetings organized by Marion Solomon, I became good friends with Dan Siegel, Norman Deutsch, Alan Shore, Diana Fascia, and Louis Cosolino. As the circle of colleagues expands, our understanding of trauma is enriched. Frequently, several of us are on the same program and have had the opportunity to conduct joint workshops. Through these interactions, I became informed about the profound disruptive impact of trauma on a significant portion of the population. I became aware that survivors of trauma often go through life without an opportunity to understand their bodily reaction to the trauma or to recover the ability to regulate and to co-regulate their physiological and behavioral state. Many of these individuals are re-victimized when discussing their experiences and are often reprimanded for not fighting or fleeing. Others are chastised for not psychologically recovering when there is no apparent physical damage. The theory stimulated interest in clinical applications. This prompted invitations for me to talk at clinically oriented meetings and to conduct workshops on polyvagal theory for clinicians. During the past few years, through the publication of The Polyvagal Theory and talks, there has been an expanding awareness of polyvagal theory across several clinical areas. This welcoming by the clinical community identified limitations in my knowledge. Although I could talk to clinicians and deconstruct their presentations of clinical cases into constructs described by the theory, I was not a clinician. I was limited in how I related the theory to clinical diagnosis, treatment, and outcome. Consistent with these limitations, I continually receive requests to provide more clinical examples in presentations. These experiences have served as the motivation to edit a volume in which clinicians describe how they have applied polyvagal theory in their own work. The current volume evolved through interactions with clinicians who shared with me their enthusiasm and creativity in integrating aspects of polyvagal theory into their work. As I discussed clinical applications with many clinicians, the idea of an edited book took form. The goal was not to have authors recapitulate the theory, but to explain how the theory enabled them to expand their work. The authors of the chapters were invited to focus their chapters on how polyvagal theory provides insights into their clinical practice, how the theory offers an organizing principle that facilitates a better understanding of clinical conditions and enhances communication with their clients. My co-editor, Deb Dana, is one of the gifted therapists that I have met on my journey. Deb has an intuitive grasp of polyvagal theory and has creatively expanded aspects of the theory into the training models that she teaches in her workshops. Her skillful translation of polyvagal theory into exercises and subjective experiences provides clinicians and their clients with a broader understanding how the theory relates to clinical features and treatment outcomes. Deb has played a major role in coordinating this volume by providing editorial guidance and support to our authors. As co-editor, she has created a network of insightful and compassionate clinicians who are generating the models and strategies for polyvagal-informed therapies. Following this preface are brief chapters from Peter Levine, Bessel van der Kolk, and Pat Ogden. Peter, Bessel, and Pat have welcomed polyvagal theory into the world of trauma therapy. Without their interest and foresight, polyvagal theory may have languished in my laboratory and not readily transitioned into traumatology. I am sincerely grateful for their passion for improving the quality of life of their clients and their commitment in bringing polyvagal theory into their models of therapy. Since all authors were asked not to retell polyvagal theory, I have written an overview chapter on the theory. Following the overview are chapters illustrating and documenting how insightful clinicians have incorporated aspects of the theory into diverse clinical settings. The chapters provide vivid examples of how polyvagal theory provides a language of the body that has enabled the authors to passionately express their desire to understand and to optimize the human experience. It is our hope that this edited volume fulfills the need for clinical examples of how polyvagal theory can improve the treatment and understanding of clinical conditions. Part 1. The Introduction of Polyvagal Theory into the World of Trauma Therapists. 1. Polyvagal Theory and Trauma. Peter A. Levine. Abstract. This chapter tells a personal story of the parallel and interactive journeys between two longtime friends and colleagues, as well as an application of polyvagal theory involving the understanding of emergent properties of complex systems, bottom-up processing, self-regulation, and the resolution of traumatic experiences. It also discusses how this application of polyvagal theory has an impact on the fields of internal medicine and trauma-related chronic pain. The map may not be the territory, but it sure helps you to get around. Peter A. Levine. In addressing the vital role played by polyvagal theory as it informs trauma-based therapies, I've chosen to take a somewhat personal and historical perspective. I begin by reflecting on a 4-decade relationship with the senior editor of this volume, a special filial friendship that developed around our shared interests and passion for bottom-up processes, emergent properties, self-regulation, and playful laughter. Since our first meeting in 1978, Stephen Porges and I have remained kindred spirits and willing co-conspirators. His work on polyvagal theory developed a key holistic concept he called neuroception. This organismic perception was an emergent property of 3 distinct autonomic, visceral, and somatic states signaling safety, danger, and life threat. During the decades that Porges was evolving his visionary theory, I was developing my life's work, called somatic experiencing. For most of the previous centuries, with the notable exception of William James and Carl Lang at the turn of the 20th century, the autonomic nervous system and visceral organs were believed to be unconscious, far outside the realm of awareness. However, it was becoming evident to me that this understanding of internal perception was limited, if not fundamentally incorrect. I learned that not only are people able to become aware of their visceral states, but that cultivating this perception is essential to taming various traumatic and other difficult sensations and emotions, including fear, rage, grief, and shame. Indeed, it became increasingly evident that these problematic affects are derivative of habitual muscular and visceral states. Crucially, in order to change our emotional states, it is first necessary to alter the underlying autonomic, visceral, and kinesthetic sensations. For this transformation, it is essential to develop a reliable interoceptive awareness. Interoception is any sense that is normally stimulated from within the body. This involves numerous sensory receptors in the muscles and in the internal organs. These receptors are neurologically linked to nuclei in the brainstem as part of a complex feedback system. Interoception is thought to be abnormal in clinical conditions such as PTSD and alexithymia. So, while mine was a clinical body awareness approach, it was clearly mirroring Porges' polyvagal theory, as this short chapter will hopefully elucidate. This unfolding story traces back to an unexpected and pivotal event that occurred in 1969 as I was developing a body-mind stress treatment modality. At that time, I was in the midst of a doctoral program in the Department of Medical and Biological Physics at UC Berkeley. In this interdisciplinary program, I was free to study in my elected fields of neurophysiology, stress research, zoology, physics, and math, as well as continuing with my clinical practice. Ed Jackson, a psychiatrist friend, knowing of my keen interest in stress and in mind-body healing, asked me to see a patient of his I'll call Nancy. At the time, I had been experimenting with a series of body awareness exercises on a group of 15 people who had significantly elevated blood pressure indicative of chronic sympathetic arousal. I had found that teaching them how to relax certain muscles in their neck, jaw, and shoulders often brought their high blood pressure to a normal level, 120 over 70, sometimes in a matter of 20 minutes. This shift would imply that a dynamic balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches of the autonomic nervous system was restored. Nancy had been suffering from what would now be called fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, irritable bowel syndrome, migraines, severe premenstrual syndrome, and urinary problems. She had also been plagued with debilitating panic attacks and agoraphobia, to the extent that she was unable to leave her house without being accompanied by her husband. Even with this critical support, such an excursion was terrifying and exhausting. Her life had become a living hell. My psychiatrist friend thought that perhaps some of my relaxation exercises might at least help with her severely limiting anxiety. With the best of intentions, I began a relaxation session with Nancy. On arrival, her heart rate was pounding at about 120 beats per minute, as seen by observing her carotid artery pulse, indicating sympathetic arousal. Her head and eyes were cast downward, assiduously avoiding any eye contact with me. I cautiously taught her how to relax certain muscles in her neck and jaw, and, to my self-satisfaction, her heart rate slowly dropped to a more normal 75 beats per minute, indicating a balanced and reciprocal relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic. I wasn't only pleased with the efficacy of my techniques, but I was grateful for her comforting improvement. However, just as she seemed to be settling, her heart rate abruptly skyrocketed to about 160 beats per minute, hyperactivation of the sympathetic system, followed by a gradual descent, much to my relief. However, my reprieve was short-lived as her heart rate rapidly plummeted to a frightful 50 beats per minute, seeming to indicate the onset of an unexpectedly powerful parasympathetic dominance. At this point, her face became deathly pale and her fingers turned icy cold. Her eyes desperately locked onto mine as she pleaded, "I'm dying. Don't let me die. Help me. Don't let me die." At that dark moment of peril, just as her pulse reached the slowest rate yet, I was able to guide her to envision an effective motoric action of escape. Out of the blue, a fleeting image of a tiger, readying to spring at its prey, had appeared to me. Following my intuition without fully understanding the significance, I engaged her in mobilizing an active defensive response by commanding, "Nancy, there's a tiger chasing you. Run! Run fast! Climb those rocks and escape!" Later, when she described her experience in the session, Nancy reported how, at first, her legs couldn't move, that they felt like lead. But then she noticed that her body was filling up with energy. She noted that, with my encouragement, she was able to stay with these challenging sensations. She could feel herself starting to move, and then running, full out, culminating in a triumphant escape. Nancy reported that after climbing the rocks, she turned and looked down, and instead of seeing the tiger, she saw herself at the age of 4, held down by several doctors and nurses who were forcing an ether mask over her face for a tonsillectomy. Nancy had been completely terrified and overwhelmed at the time. Her body had, for 20 years, needed to mobilize an active escape. She finally did this, retrospectively, in response to the evocative image of the tiger, introduced at the critical moment of her collapse. Her successful escape was now embodied in the emergence of a new, reconsolidated, procedural memory engram, one of power and agency instead of helplessness and defeat. During the session, Nancy experienced waves of shaking and trembling, cycles of heart rate changes and changes in temperature, from cold to hot and finally to an even, warm skin tone. Each of these cycles was followed by deep, spontaneous breaths. At the end of her session, she opened her eyes and looked toward me, this time without fear and grasping, but rather with the spontaneous delight of mutual connection. As we shared this soft gaze together, she reported that she felt in her body as though she was being held in waves of tingling warmth. We continued with a few more sessions. Afterward, she reported that many of her physical symptoms had resolved or greatly improved, and she was able to resume her doctoral work, ironically, in physiology. Later, at a 2-year follow-up, she had not experienced any further panic attacks and was enjoying exploring the many interesting things that Berkeley had to offer. Needless to say, I began to try to understand her extreme physiological changes and the salubrious effect at the end of the session. In order to comprehend what had happened in the session, as well as her long-term improvement, I was pulled in several directions. First, I was finding pieces of the puzzle in the field of ethology, the study of wild animals in their natural environments, as well as my evolving understanding of the autonomic nervous system. In 1969, some months before my encounter with Nancy, I was participating in a weekly seminar on animal behavior in the zoology department. One of the professors, Dr. Peter Marler, an ethologist, had mentioned an obscure biological phenomenon. He described how, when a wild animal is physically restrained without a struggle, it enters a dramatically immobilized state called tonic immobility, known by the colloquial phrase playing possum. During tonic immobility, the animal's respiration is so faint that one can barely detect life. To the naked eye, it looks dead. However, it is not just playing dead. Instead, the animal has entered a profound physiological state, one sometimes called thanatosis, because of its apparent similarity to death. In this state, an animal's heart rate typically drops to an extreme low because of parasympathetic dominance. Such an animal spontaneously recovers from this paralytic state in a matter of seconds to minutes, usually after the predator has left the scene. However, if the animal is frightened before or during the restraint, it remains locked in this death-like state for a much longer time. This, I reasoned, was what had happened to Nancy when she was held down, physically immobilized and terrified. When visiting a physiology laboratory at the Federal Medical University of Brazil, one of the few groups studying the neural substrates of immobility, I had the rare opportunity to observe guinea pigs who were first frightened and then physically restrained. As these terrified animals struggled to escape, their heart rates, like Nancy's, were initially very high, just as you would expect in an animal activating a fight-or-flight response, that is, sympathetic dominance. However, as their frantic struggles continued, their heart rates and respiration suddenly dropped, precipitously, to a very low level, that is parasympathetic dominance.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?